celestial chariots soaring through the skies. Powerful gods drawn to the smoke of sacrifices. Prophetic visions that unveil mysteries beyond our comprehension. What if these ancient accounts, found in the Bible and other sacred texts, were not just myths or symbolic tales, but detailed records of humanity's distant past? Mauro Bellino is an internationally best-selling Italian author, researcher, and highly regarded scholar of ancient Hebrew. For many years, he worked for Rome's St. Paul Press as a Bible translator, providing with great precision the literal meaning of Hebrew words for Vatican-approved interlinear Bibles. It is an exacting discipline. The scholar must be rigorous in avoiding any kind of interpretation of the word and give only the literal etymological meaning of each word part. Mauro's findings set him at odds with the conventional expectations of the Catholic world and propelled him onto the international stage where his work has opened up a world of cultural memory recorded in the Bible, yet hidden from the public for centuries by mistaken translation and the dogmas of the Church.
Good morning. Today we return to talking about the relationship between the Bible and Homer, specifically about flying machines. I go back to talking about this topic, which, as I've already said, is a fairly sensitive topic because obviously many absolutely don't want to hear about it. But since these texts talk about it, we cannot help but examine those passages. And when we have already talked about flying machines as far as Homer is concerned, we talked about these celestial chariots, which are driven by horses that make noise above, by horses that are under the chariots. So much so that when Zeus says he wants to hit the chariot used by Athena, he says that it hits the horses that are under the chariots. They are chariots that in an instant cover the distance that a man sees looking at the sea while sitting on the top of a mountain. They are chariots which, as is also described in the Bible, are often accompanied by clouds. And therefore, in short, there are a whole series of elements that recall the various stories. Now let's move forward, and today we will see, especially in the final part of the chat, some translations which are either problematic, precisely because evidently the ancients tried to tell us, unfortunately with words they did not possess, things that they saw. So the translations may appear, let's say, almost deliberately misleading to give the idea that it is one thing rather than another. But we see the real meanings in the end. Let's go back for a moment to a concept that I have already talked about, which was the one relating to the way in which the so-called Greek gods moved. In the Iliad, in Book 13, there is the story of Poseidon who goes to harangue the Greeks so that they resist the attack of the Trojans. To do this, Poseidon disguises himself as Calchas, but when he leaves, Ajax recognizes that it was not Calchas, and he says, "The footprints of his feet from behind, the shape of his legs I easily recognized as he left. The gods understand each other," meaning that the gods are recognizable. Now I don't know if it is the fifth or sixth video that I dedicate to Homer and the Bible, and this is one of the two books, The False Testament, together with The Bible Does Not Speak of God, dedicated precisely to this theme, in which I analyzed in detail the things I am telling you. And in this book, I had cited the Ethiopians of Heliodorus, who, taking up this very passage from the Iliad, also explained why the Egyptians depicted the gods in a certain way. In the Ethiopians, he writes, "The explanation is the following. The gods show themselves in human form to strike men, and in this way they can hide from the profane, but cannot escape the wise. They can be recognized by the eyes that always have a fixed gaze, and the eyelids motionless, but above all from the gait. They They in fact advanced with their feet together without moving them one after the other. And they cut through the surrounding air with an irresistible movement and impetus instead of walking. For this very reason, the Egyptians make statues of the gods with their feet joined and almost fused together. This type of movement is also noted in the Homeric poems. Here we are still in the Iliad. In book 14, we talk about Hera, who, after speaking with Aphrodite, launches herself into one of the many missions, into one of the many journeys, and in verse 186, it is written, "Under her soft feet, she tied her sandals beautiful." These sandals are the ones that are normally referred almost exclusively to Mercury, Hermes, the so-called winged messenger of the gods. In reality, these sandals are also used by other divinities. That is, these flying objects that the gods tie under their feet to ensure that they travel with their feet together. And in fact, continuing to read this story, it is said it was a leap left, the peak of Olympus, came down into Pieria, into the lovely Emesia, launched itself towards the snowy peaks of the Thracians, and with its feet did not touch the earth. From Athos, it threw itself towards the wavy sea. Therefore they went both on land and on water, without touching them, or almost without touching them. From this description, and if we read these as real events, it means that they were traveling very close to the surface. After which, Hera was always with another divinity. Homer says, "Here they left the sea and went over the land. Under their feet, they bent the tops of the woods." This confirms the fact that they traveled very close to the surface. Then, subsequently, if we go to the Odyssey, we have another story, which in some respects is even more explanatory. Here we are talking precisely about the divinity of Hermes, that is, the winged messenger who was sent to Calypso to warn her to let Ulysses go, because Ulysses must make his way and must return home. Then, once again, immediately under his feet, he tied the beautiful sandals. And here we are in Hermes, that is Mercury, beautiful ambrosial, golden sandals, which carried him over the sea and the infinite earth together with the breath of the wind. And this recalls the concept of Ruach, which, in the Bible, always accompanies one of the instruments with which they flew. The Elohim moved accompanied by the one called Ruach, which precisely means wind, and here we have a very precise, very particular reference. On the Pieria, he leapt from the sky onto the sea and launched himself onto the waves like the seagull, a seagull with thick wings bathed in salt water. Similar to this, on the infinite waves Hermes ran. But when he arrived on the distant island, that is the island of Calypso, then from the livid sea, he jumped onto the shore and went. And so on. So this instrument, as we saw before for Hera, is transporting them indifferently on the land and on the sea. Among other things, here there is a curious thing relating to a theme that I've spoken about many times, but I like to remember it here for a moment because when he arrives on this island, he drinks, eats, and yet then he complains about this mission. This fact is curious. He complains that Zeus sent him there and says, "Zeus forced me to come down here reluctantly." Think how concrete this story is. And who would willingly cross so much infinite seawater? That is, he made a trip that was really annoying for him to make. He didn't want to do it, and he says that there isn't even a city near here of mortals who make offerings to the gods, chosen massacres. So here he complains that he was forced to make a long journey, and we have seen how the trip was probably in a way that was not exactly very comfortable, and he complains about the fact that there are no mortals there who carry out massacres. That is, who make these offerings of burnt animals, in particular of burnt fat, but maybe we will have the opportunity to go back to talking about it later. Because even here, in the Homeric poems, it says how it had to be prepared. Exactly the same as in the Bible, there are precise indications, I would say indications of precise butchery, that Yahweh gives to his followers, and why these hecatombs, these sacrifices, in which the victim was consumed to produce smoke. These massacres produced precisely that smoke which the divinities liked very much. The Greek divinities liked it, and it is said several times, over and over again, it pleased the biblical Elohim. In the book of Numbers alone, Yahweh says several times that that smoke calmed him. The Sumerian, Akkadian, Anunnaki also liked it. When it is said that, after the flood, the so-called Sumerian Noah burns many victims, and the Anunnaki are attracted by the smoke. So say the Sumerian Akkadian stories in the official translations. They are attracted like flies to the flesh. So, this smoke really attracted them, so much so that, I repeat, we have just read, that Hermes complains about the fact that there is no one there to provide it for him. Now, I have spoken about this smoke several times. I have also written about it in books, and the substance is always the same. The smoke produced precise effects that are well described, and in fact, there are aromatic compounds that seem to behave like those neurotransmitters in the smoke that undoubtedly produce a sense of relaxation, a sense of calm, or a sense of euphoria. So, regardless of the composition and molecular structure, the substance does not change, so everyone, the Greeks, the Bible, the Sumerians, tell us that the deities wanted that smoke because that smoke calmed them. That smoke gave them a sense of relaxation, a sense of euphoria. So here we have seen these stories that start with this tool for moving around, that traveled both on land and on water. And this cannot help but bring to mind what is written in the very first verses of the Bible, where it speaks of the Ruach of the Elohim. In verse 2 it says that the earth was without form and void, verse 2 of Genesis, and darkness was over the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. So here is that translation. Here, for example, in this other Bible, it says that the Spirit of God was on the surface of the waters. They are two translations, as you can see, totally different, because giving the idea that the Spirit of God was on the surface of the waters gives the idea of something stable, that is, something real. Instead, here they say, hovered. And in fact, this is the correct translation because in Hebrew, there is the word merashifet, which really means hovering, and it is the same verb that the Bible uses in the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 32. When it talks about the eagle which hovers over its offspring, that is, over its chicks, and therefore truly gives the idea of flying, staying on the surface of the water without moving its wings. But the other interesting thing is this. In both translations it says, the Spirit of God. In reality, in Hebrew, it says, Ruach of Elohim. There is no article. And this is important because it means to say that a Ruach of Elohim hovered on the surface of the waters. Not the Spirit of God. It is a totally different thing because the Elohim could have more than one of these Ruach. Here he tells us that un Ruach and, as I say in the videos, in which I suggest replacing the Italian translations with Hebrew verses. This is one of those terms that must be replaced with Hebrew verses. Let's not translate it, because translating with the Spirit of God is truly a theological translation, and therefore we leave Ruach. We say that a Ruach of Elohim hovered, that is, it had this typical flight of birds of prey with firm wings on the surface of the waters. And And we will see later that in reality, these Elohim really had a lot of tools to move around. And I would say that we can move on to a description of other flying objects. Jeff Benner is the president, founder, and director of the Center for Ancient Hebrew Studies. When he talks about the term ruach, in effect, he says that it is something that travels following a path, that is, a pre-established route. And he says it clearly in one of the dictionaries that he wrote, in this case, the one in which he analyzes 1,000 verbs and words of particular importance. He says that since ruach has a very extensive semantic value, obviously since it is about wind, and given that Hebrew is, like all the others, a polysemous language, ruach comes to have other meanings. For example, it also comes to have the meaning of identifying the character of man. Not the spirit, not the soul, but the character. Like how we say that a man has a fighting spirit, or a player has a team spirit. This is the same meaning, so in reality it passes as wind. Just as in Italian spirit means both grappa, that is, distilling the spirit from the mark, and ghosts, and indeed an attitude of a person such as team spirit. In Hebrew it is exactly the same thing. So, when we read ruach in Hebrew, we take the context into account. Here we have a ruach hovering on the surface of the waters. But then we have other, let's say, flying vehicles. These flying vehicles are always interpreted either allegorically, symbolically, or metaphorically, and are mostly defined as visions or as dreams. We are in the book of Zechariah, who, in the fourth chapter, is talking to an angel, a malach, who explains a whole series of things to him, and, at the beginning of the fourth chapter, says, "The malach who spoke to me returned again and woke me up like someone who is woken up in his sleep." So there is no doubt here. We cannot say that Zechariah dreamed, or he had dream visions. And what does Zechariah see? "I raised my eyes again, so the gesture is clear. Look up, and I saw a scroll flying." Rotolo is the right translation. Why? Because he says, "I saw a Megillah." Now, Megillah is the term with which the Jews indicated the papyrus scrolls in which they kept their texts. Therefore, cylinders. So he says that after raising his eyes, he sees a cylinder which is flying, and he is awake, undoubtedly awake. And the malach asks him, "What do you see?" He says, "I see a scroll, therefore a Megillah, which flies. Its length is 20 cubits and its width 10. So he is awake, he raises his eyes, looks up, sees a cylinder flying, and gives us its dimensions. If we then want to think that it is a vision, we are free to do so. We read what is written as a true account of events. "I lifted up my eyes." Again he looks up and sees an ephah coming. Ephah is a term that is not translated, because in the Bible, it generally indicated a unit of measurement for cereals. But here, in this case, obviously it is not. The semantic value is obviously much broader, but no one translates it because they don't know how to translate it. And luckily it is left like that. Then this ephah arrives, and we are in chapter 5. "Then a lead lid was lifted." So it has a lead trap door. "And behold, a single woman sitting inside the ephah." So it is another flying object inside, and there is a woman. But it's not over. Two other women arrive in flight and approach the ephah. And Zechariah asks the angel, "I asked the angel who spoke to me, where are they taking the ephah? He answered me, to build a dwelling in the land of Sennar. Sennar is Sumer for the Bible. As soon as it is ready, they will place the ephah on its pedestal. That is, a platform is built on which this ephah will rest. So we have a Megillah, we have an ephah, but it's not over. Chapter 6. I raised my eyes again, so he is undoubtedly awake and equally undoubtedly looks upwards. I raised my eyes again and looked. Behold, four chariots appeared between the two mountains. The mountains were of copper. That is, there are four chariots which here have the name of Merkava or Merkavot in the plural, which appear in the middle of two mountains, towers, metal buildings, and these four chariots, following an order, travel on the earth in four directions to do, let's say, a certain type of control. And here too, exactly as in Homer, these chariots are pulled by horses, horses that go in different directions. But again, we see that the ancients used the linguistic tools they had to describe what it was, the element that it carried. That is, what made these chariots advance. So here, in Zechariah, we have three other types of, let's call them, celestial chariots. We have the Megillah, the Ephah, and these other chariots which we are therefore going to add to the Ruach, which we have already talked about. Now, let's go back to it. Let's add to the Kavod we have already talked about. But we have the opportunity of returning to it. We come to what is known as the so-called rapture of Elijah. Kidnapping is also a wrong definition because Elijah was not kidnapped. Elijah knew well that he would have to get on the Ruach of the Elohim and go away with them, so much so that the Bible itself says so from the first chapter of the second book of Kings. It says there, when Yahweh was about to lift Elijah into heaven in a whirlwind, he left Galgala with Elisha. Therefore, Elijah leaves, knowing that he will then have to travel with Yahweh and the Elohim. The interesting thing is that during this journey that he makes on foot to go to the place where he will then climb onto the Elohim's chariot, he meets the disciples. He leaves with his disciple Elisha. But others join the journey, and everyone knows that Elijah is about to leave with the chariot of the Elohim. Everyone knows it's not a vision, it's something planned. So much so that they walk for several days, and reaching various inhabited centers, other disciples join, and at the end, 50 disciples also went and stopped in front of them from afar. They are Elijah and Elisha, and they stopped from afar while the two went as far as Jordan. Now, while they were walking and talking, here is the chariot of fire with the horses of fire. A description exactly the same as the one we saw in the Homeric poems. This chariot of fire, which is called Reshev, and it comes between the two. Elijah gets on the chariot and goes away in a whirlwind. This is an important concept that we will soon find in those translations. Now, it is clear that it is not a vision because Elijah voluntarily goes to the place where he knows he will get on the chariot. It is clear that it is not a kidnapping because Elijah goes voluntarily. It is clear that it is a planned action because all the disciples are aware of it. It is clear that it is a concrete action. Why? Because immediately after the event occurs, the disciples go to look for him because they say, let them go to look for Elijah. Perhaps the Ruach of Yahweh lifted him up and threw him on some mountain or in some valley. But he replied, Elisha, don't send them. However, they insisted. That is, they were so certain of this concrete action that they say, we saw him take it, he took it up, he took it away, he must have deposited it somewhere, and so let's go look for him. They searched for him for 3 days but did not find him. And nothing would ever be known about Elijah again until the moment in which he reappears together with Moses, when Jesus has the famous transfiguration and is one of the two undead. One of the two, the other is Moses. One of the two undead who present themselves to Jesus. I say undead because you will remember that I have already talked about how Josephus tells us that Moses, when he had to go to die, goes to the valley of Moab, then a cloud arrives and takes him away. He is taken away on a cloud, and Josephus says, I've read it to you at least a couple of times, that Moses was forced to write that he was dead, so that no one would say that he had gone away with the divinities. So Elijah, like Moses, leaves with the deities exactly as Enoch had done previously. So here too, we have another event which cannot be defined as a dream, which cannot be defined as a vision, because it is very concrete. Dozens of people witness it, and it is so concrete that these dozens of people decide to go and look for Elijah, convinced that Elijah would be deposited somewhere around there. But now we come to some translations which are very interesting, and we return to the book of Ezekiel, which I already read to you last time, but here we see a new element. A new element in chapter 10. Ezekiel gives us a whole series of descriptions of the movements, of the noises that Yahweh's kavod makes. He tells us how this kavod is in some way mechanically connected to the cherubim, how they get up together, how they move, how they make noise. A noise which, when they are inside the external courtyard of the temple, can be heard by those who are outside the walls of the courtyard, who therefore do not see what happens, but hear what happens. So it is clear that it is not a vision that concerns Ezekiel exclusively, but he says that at a certain point, and here we are in chapter 10, verse 13. When talking about wheels that are precisely connected to these, he says, I felt that the wheels were called turbines. Now, in Hebrew there is hegel gal, that is, there is the article. If we had to translate exactly, we should say, these wheels were called the whirlwind. And this is a translation that is very interesting, because it is found in various Bibles. Other Bibles, in the uncertainty of the translation of this term, Galgal, prefer not to translate it. Furthermore, Galgal would actually mean a wheel that swirls. And so, hearing that the wheels were called the wheel is trivial. So it is clear that the author of this verse wanted to indicate with this galgal something very particular. For example, the Greek Bible of the 70s does not translate it. Evidently, they did not know how to render it, and therefore in Greek it renders it as gelgel, which is also not found in the dictionaries, in the sense that it does not have a meaning. It is left as it is with a transliteration. This French Bible, verse 10 to where 13, translates, the wheels were called tourbillons, and in the note, it says that it therefore indicated whirling wheels, roues tourbillonnantes. Therefore, it specifies that they were particular wheels. I would almost be tempted to shift the emphasis. Instead of turbine, say turbine because that would correspond, but this is my thought. So, take it that way. What I mean is, the descriptions we have actually make us think about this, above all the fact that the author of Ezekiel felt the need to indicate it precisely. And that therefore, he didn't mean the wheels are called wheels because it's so banal, that it would be downright ridiculous. This Bible published by the Geneva Bible House, which is the one that publishes Bibles for the whole world, also here says, I heard that the wheels were called whirlwinds. Martin Luther's Bible, however, does something even simpler. It leaves the term as it is, Galgal. So evidently Luther also had doubts about the translation, and I understand them. So even in this case, I am very pleased to find whirlwinds in the normal translations because I know well that if I translated it like this, or even worse, if I shifted the emphasis, one could say that Biglino is precisely interpreting. Turbine is the definition that we find in various Bibles. Others, as we have seen, prefer not to translate it. And in my opinion, this is the right thing. But what is certain is that they were very particular wheels. Then Ezekiel in chapter 11 continues to tell us all this set of events that is all this movement that the kavod of Yahweh makes with the cherubim. It lands on them. Then together they rise up, and he says, the cherubim then raised their wings, and the wheels moved. They moved together with them, while the kavod of Yahweh of Israel was above them. Then from the center of the city, the kavod of Yahweh rose up and went to stand on the mountain, which is east of the city. So Ezekiel is absolutely awake, because he tells us a whole series of very precise events. And now, let's see how he concludes. And a ruach, here he comes again. And a ruach lifted me up and took me to Chaldea among the deportees. That is, he had been taken by a ruach. We have already seen it other times. And taken to Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, he witnesses a series of events and actions carried out by these flying vehicles. After which, the ruach takes him and back to the place where he was in exile together with the other deportees. And at the end of all this, you hear what happens. And the vision that I had seen disappeared before me. Too bad this translation has nothing to do with what is written in Hebrew. I understand that whoever has to explain to us that this is a vision, then in the translations also tries to, let's say, introduce the concept that facilitates this type of interpretation. But now, let's go and see what exactly is written in Hebrew. Here we have what is exactly written in Hebrew, Va'al me'alai, which means exactly, and he ascended from above me. So, this is the literal meaning of the Hebrew verse. So, what is written in Hebrew has nothing to do with a vision that disappears. There is a clear concept there. What he saw rises up and goes away from above him. Now, this is a precise description. It is not a vision, and least of all, it is something that disappears. That is, here, really, this little phrase here that we saw in Hebrew could easily be used at the airport when one sees a plane and says, and the plane came up from above me. This is written there, and one may not even like it. I realize it, I understand it perfectly. I understand perfectly those who, let's say, do not want or cannot accept, and therefore have to transform into a vision. What is instead a description? Or, better yet, a set of precise descriptions of precise, concrete events. Mechanical, noisy, seen several times. We even saw in the previous video, Ezekiel saying that, in the second vision, he says, then I understood there. I understood in the second event. I understood that those were the cherubs that I had seen the first time on the riverbank. So, he even connects these true experiences that he lived. So, this is important. This is important why? Because it makes us understand how the Bible is extremely concrete. If we then want to transform them into a vision, or do we mean that when the author of the book of Ezekiel, or, as we saw before, Zechariah, or the one who narrated the events of Elijah, tells us one thing, he means another. Then I allow myself to say that we must demonstrate it. That is, we must say, I am, I was in the author's head. and I know that when he wrote one thing, he meant another. If we instead stick to what is written, we find everything absolutely coherent. I have already read to you other times what Professor Moraldi says, that in the apocryphal texts, in particular in the Hebrew version of the Book of Enoch, there is even talk of 23 different types of divine chariots. In Eastern texts, we still talk about larger numbers of different chariots. Here in the Bible, we have seen at least Ruach, Kevod, Cherubim, Merkava, Epha, Reshev, Megillah. In short, there are a whole series of definitions that tend to identify different means, some of which, due to their characteristics, as we have seen, are even defined as a chariot of fire, horses of fire, exactly as they are defined in the Homeric poems. So, in this continuation of pretending that, there is really a lot of concreteness, after which, I repeat, this is what is written. From then on, anyone who wants to is obviously free to interpret, but must expressly declare that beyond what is written, from that moment on, the interpretation begins. Because what is written is extremely concrete and precise. Thank you. Bye, and see you next time.